of things I've never tried is not having this in my pocket. You suppose it works?
That way?
I don't know.
Probably.
But since I don't have any earphones, I can't tell. So we're going to take this on faith. Okay, this is the review session for HTF 60 at 3:30 on the 30th of February. Or the 2nd of March. Right? Okay, I really don't know how that picks up. All right, we'll try that. If it doesn't work, the heck with it. People will shoot me. We'll try it. I should have tested it first. Okay, you think it's not the 30th of March, is that?
Definitely
not the 30th of March. I mean February. Not the 30th of February. Okay. All right. Don't despair on the web. We're here. We're just not talking. Because I'm resetting the date on my watch. Second, it's interesting that I hadn't noticed it, and it's already the same. Okay, what do you need to know? What would you like to know? How can we use our time effectively?
So is this happening daily, like what we went over yesterday in class?
Not mainly. There's typically, we haven't finished the test yet, so I really don't trust this, so I'm going to do what I know works. Put it in the pocket. There we go. There. Normally, what we have is one of those interpretation items with several questions, and there's a section that's just the definitions. Just match the word with the definitions. There's a section of thinking of ways to improve or recognizing. It's not even thinking of, but we'll make some suggestions about ways you could improve a setting or improve a microsystem, and we'll give you choices of what things you think would do that. Make it more developmentally facilitating, and just pick the ones that are correct. Typically, there's a section of statements using the various terms, and again, some of them are wrong and some of them are right, and you get to choose which ones are right. And we may do one. I liked the idea that I had during lecture yesterday of having a situation, a brief statement of a situation, and then giving two or three hypotheses and asking which ones would apply to that particular situation. I don't know if I'll do that. It means making up something new, so depends on how much time I have tomorrow. So it's all very straightforward. There's no tricky stuff in it. If you know the material and the concepts, they're evident. And
so,
yeah, a lot of it is linked, but it's really important to be clear about the distinction between the microsystem and the mesosystem. It's really important to understand the various ways that settings in a mesosystem can be related to each other, and which of those ways are good for the developing person. And essentially, they all boil down to the more agreement there is, and the more congruity, the more your mesosystem makes sense in supporting your development. The more people agree in it, and the more people are related to each other, and the more people like each other, and the more activities they do with each other, all of those things, then the better it is for you. And they're pretty straightforward, I think. I try to encourage people not to get all wrapped up in the details of the hypotheses, but it is important to be able to read them and understand where he's going, what Bronfenbrenner means by them. That's why we've gone over them in class.
When recognizing the hypotheses, do you mean like, oh, that involves like reciprocity, or that involves...
Yeah, that kind of thing.
Are the true and false, like, the words, like, picky, or, like...
They're a little picky on the true-false. They are picky... Hi, Joanna. They're picky in the sense that you really do have to use the concepts accurately. And if you don't read carefully, or if you don't think carefully about the different, for example, in one section, I'm likely to pair a correct statement and an incorrect statement, and they'll be different only in a word or two. So you have to really think about the difference between the two statements to pick out which one is the correct use of the concept and which is not. And those are important because it's helpful to have the language so that you're using it all correctly. As an example, people will sometimes say that their mesosystems have a lot of settings in them. But each person only has one mesosystem. So the correct usage would be, my mesosystem has a number of settings in it, not my mesosystems, because you only have one. There are things like, I'm trying to think of some of the mistakes that people typically make that we try to correct. People will talk about a setting that they go into, which they don't share with anybody in their family, but they'll talk about it as being an important setting in their family's mesosystem or their mother's mesosystem. But if mother never goes into it, it's not in her mesosystem. It's an exosystem setting for mother. It may be a mesosystem setting for the child or the student, but not for the parent. And it's important to be able to keep those separate. Whose mesosystem are we talking about? And being clear. So it's primarily a matter of reading carefully and thinking carefully about the concepts. Some of the other things that are important, sort of typical problems in using the concepts, if I ask a question about a relation or a dyad and ask about its characteristics, you should automatically think of reciprocity and power and affect. You know, that should just be natural. So talking about a dyad as a really good dyad doesn't do the trick. You have to talk about it in terms of its affect and its power, the balance of power, and the reciprocity in it. Or sometimes have an item that, a story or something, an appropriate question will be, how did the dyad change? And people say it fell apart. That it might have fallen apart, but can you describe that in terms of affect, power, and relationship, or in reciprocity? Have you started thinking about the fourth exercise, the fourth assignment, a little bit? You have a event or series of events in mind to write about?
Yeah, I was thinking about writing about eating dinner with my family every night throughout my life.
How
the conversation changes, and when I'm in trouble, I dread it. Just like going home a couple weekends ago, like, I could just sit there for hours and find myself. Mm-hmm. In sixth grade, I would just want to get out.
Yeah. Puberty's tough.
Yeah. It was Sunday night dinner. Just for a weekend. Yeah. Trouble.
Creates negative affect.
Yeah.
He's having a good time, but you're not. Yes, you should be familiar with the propositions. There aren't many, but the ones that there are important.
So we should, like, know each definition, each hypothesis?
You don't need to know each hypothesis in the sense of being able to recite it, but you should recognize. I mean, I won't give you a false hypothesis. I won't do that. So the question with the hypotheses is understanding the gist of them so that you can think about how, if you take all the hypotheses about mesosystems, for example, and you wanted to describe how to create a good mesosystem, you could apply those main ideas from those hypotheses. For the definitions, you should be able to recognize them. So if I give you I don't have them off the top of my head either, so I can't even tell you what I would give you. But if I gave you, for example, relationships among settings in which the developing person actively participates, you should recognize that as the definition of mesosystem. If I say the settings that you don't participate in, but where things happen that affect you in the settings where you are, or that are affected by what happens in the settings where you actively participate, that's a definition of exosystem. So if you read those definitions, you should be able to recognize which is mesosystem, which is exo, which is macrosystem. And that's just a matter of being familiar with the basics. The definition of human development.
Do you
have
to know about
chronosystem? No, we won't talk about the chronosystem, and I won't ask that anything about that on this. We will later. We just didn't do anything that really talked much about that. It's a general concept. It just simply means things change across time in sometimes systematic ways. The propositions are important to understand because there's basically the beliefs in the system. What do you assume to be true? And And that's true in any theory. The propositions are what you assert to be true, on which you build all the rest of it. And proposition F asserts that the physical characteristics of a setting determine what's likely to happen there. And proposition C says that if you have a dyad and one person in it changes, particularly if it's a developmental change, then the other person is likely to go through some developmental change too. So as you went through puberty, that's a developmental change for you. Your parents had to change the way they related to you. Your big brother changed. So the point is that it's a transactional system that he's talking about, and if one person changes, then everybody else is likely to go through change too, because it's a system. Proposition A, there must be one. Proposition B, I remember. Proposition B says that the way we're going to know somebody's developmental status or how well developed they are is by looking at the complexity and variety of molar activities that she engages in on her own when nobody's telling her what to do. So if I ask you a question about a change in developmental status, as there is in assignment 4, then you should be thinking about changes in the complexity or variety or both of the molar activities that the person is engaging in. If a person's developmental status goes down, it means their activities get simpler, the ones they do on their own.
Yeah. I have my own drive.
Mm-hmm. It means that you think of things on your own.
Mm-hmm.
You don't have to have somebody telling you what to do. If you're at a higher level of development, you're curious about things, you seek things out to do. You engage in complex activities instead of channel surfing. Some would argue that watching 52 channels at the same time is complex, but others would argue that that's pretty simple because it's passive. You've probably dated people who can't think of anything to do briefly. Dated them briefly, I mean. And you like to hang out with people who have ideas and are interested in things. We don't find proposition A. That's really interesting. There must be a proposition A. Okay, there's an interesting challenge. I'll have to find proposition A. That's really funny. It's not in the Developmentology book, but it's in Bronfenbrenner somewhere. That's funny. I'm sorry, where is it? Research design.
Yeah,
proposition A and E and G. And G prime are all there on page 68. Okay. So now we've located A. That means you have to find, when you're looking at something, particularly in research, you have to think about it systematically, systemically. You've got to think of it as a system. So A is that, B is developmental status, C is transactional change, D. There is a D, okay. I've never tried to do that, think of all the propositions. E is again about research settings or second order relationships. F is about settings, physical characteristics. G and G prime are about ecological validity in research. So it's D where... D's on page 36. Ah, yes. An analysis of the microsystem must take into account the full interpersonal system operating in a given setting. This system will typically include all the participants present, not excluding the investigator, and involve the reciprocal relations between them. In other words, you've got to think about the whole thing. That was assignment 2B. Right? Describe a microsystem and the pattern of roles, relationships, and activities. And boy, that one gets complex really quickly. Okay, all propositions present and accounted for. I'm sorry?
The proposition page.
Which is?
It says different settings have different developments.
Ah, yes.
Okay.
Right. The proposition H is saying that if you see settings having different effects, there ought to be some differences between the settings that help explain those effects. And those are propositions because you can't test them, they're beliefs. You accept them and say, okay, this is what we believe, and now we go on from there. We use those concepts to provide the basis for everything else. You have other questions you want to ask about? We can do an exercise if you want.
I have a question about hypothesis 27.
Hypothesis 27. Okay.
Where if you go into these settings, like you want to go to like you
don't
have all settings now. Why don't you go to catch? Because like I don't know anything else that I came here, but isn't it supposed to be like really a place to like grow and develop?
Yeah. What do you think?
I think it depends on the person.
And what about the person? It depends on the person, but what about the person?
Well, the relationship, I guess. Like, just if the kids who went to college with their boyfriends,
mm-hmm.
some of them, it just kind of keeps them away from everyone else. Mm-hmm. But for some other couples, they can go out and
Mm-hmm.
Do their own thing, and I guess it depends on their diet.
Yeah. Yeah. Right. Okay. So the key, what some people have described in the class in their various exercises, is that it is easier to come here if you come with somebody else that you know. And that makes it comfortable the first few days. So you don't get as homesick, you don't have as much anxiety, you don't have to wander around being lost. Some people have said it helps if you have an older sibling or friends of an older sibling who are here who will take you under their wing and make sure you get to the right parties and you can find the bookstore and things like that, and so you don't get lost. It's nice to have somebody kind of looking out for you. And then it's important that you do your own branching out. And they often, students will describe a situation where they know somebody who is depending on the person from home or the boyfriend and not meeting anybody else and not learning to navigate on her own and not learning the setting because she's dependent on that relationship. So she's not really growing in the new setting. So the question would be, why does that happen? And how can you make sure that people do move beyond the original dyad or transcontextual dyad that they came in with? But the proposition is talking about the hypothesis is talking about the initial entry. And then some of them talk about having the transcontextual dyads, but not exclusively. And then the other thing that's important in that one is its connection to hypothesis 37. This hypothesis, I think it's 37. Check me. That's the one that says that these several relationships from hypothesis 34, and it's actually more than that. Depend on how developmentally mature you are and how comfortable you are in the settings that you're in. And what that is suggesting is that there may be a point where it's developmentally appropriate for you to go into some place on your own. That you pick a new setting, go into it, test yourself. But that means you've got the skills to create new relationships, to engage in new activities, and you're developed well enough that you don't need that transcontextual dyad to get comfortable in the new setting. And you're ready. In a sense, it's suggesting that it may not be good for you to be too comfortable, that growth may take a little bit of discomfort, disequilibrium in Piaget's sense, and then you move on. So there may be a time when you leave home without your best friend. Or another kind of analysis that has been applied to that, an example is going to someplace new, having the friends from home, the people who know you at the beginning, and then they take off, so they're not there. You know, parents come, make sure you have everything you need in your room, make sure you're comfortable, so they're actually reducing their anxiety a bit when they come to make sure you're okay. And then they go home, and then you're okay. Last fall, I had a wonderful example. I haven't used it in class, but I had an example in August. The day before move-in day for first-year, first-time students, there was a new student, as it turned out, struggling with three huge suitcases trying to cross Main Street toward Living Learning. And she was struggling one at a time. She was taking them from the north side of the street to the island in the middle and going back and get another one. And she couldn't lift them. She was dragging them. And one of them had a broken wheel, and it was hot, and she was struggling. And so I stopped to help her, and we got everything off on the other side of the street. And then I asked her, new student, where are you headed? And it turned out she was headed to CBW, so we'd taken the suitcases the wrong way. But she didn't know where it was. And so I got my car, and we loaded him in and took her, and I helped her get him up to the third floor. She had just gotten off a bus and had arrived at UVM, having never been here before. She hadn't been able to come for orientation. She had never been here for a new student visit, potential student. Her first day on campus was as a new first-year student, and got off the bus by herself, and here she was. She was ready for that. Yeah. And I asked her about it, and I had coffee with her later, three weeks later, to see how she was doing. And she was doing fine. No problem. Yeah, she was, here I am. And she'd had other experiences where she had gone into completely new settings, and she just knew she could do it. She was a wonderful example of Proposition 37. You know, just take off. Or Hypothesis 37, don't let me confuse those. She was ready to take off and go someplace entirely different on her own, and she had the skills to settle in and make friends and learn the lay of the land, and she was fine. She had actually met another student on the bus who was coming, but that student didn't get off here. She was with her parents, and they had gone on downtown, so they were separated, and she didn't know where the other student was living, so they hadn't done enough to create a dyad that was going to continue at that point. So Hypothesis 27 has its limits. It has its limits. And Bronfenbrenner is really mostly concerned about children. And sometimes it applies to adolescents, and you can think about it applying to other people, but there are times when you don't need all those supports. You want to do an interpretive exercise? Not interpretive dance, interpretive exercise. Okay. Can you read that? Yeah, okay. For those of you on the web listening to this, I will put this example on the web as an overhead. It's the one that says, Jenny notices Ralph in the cafeteria where they work. The third time he comes over and asks if he can sit with her. They chat over several lunches in the next 2 weeks and begin to look forward to seeing each other. Then Ralph invites Jenny to go to a party with him. After dating for 6 months, Jenny and Ralph decide to live together, so when Ralph's roommate moves out, Jenny moves in. They rearrange the furniture to make room for the things Jenny brought. The apartment is a bit grubby, so Jenny cleans it thoroughly. They have fun figuring out where things go and planning meals together. Ralph has never cooked much, but he loves to eat and appreciates Jenny's attempts to teach him to do more than microwave. Over the next several months, they fall into a comfortable routine. Jenny cleans the apartment every week and does Ralph's laundry when she does hers. They do the grocery shopping together, but Jenny does most of the menu planning and cooking. Okay, I know. The initial reaction is... What? He should be doing more. Okay, this is traditional what? These are traditional whats? Stereotypes refer to... Male and female roles. Roles. Okay. So... if we look at a possible question, would be what roles are described here? So, and what do you got? Roles. co-workers? Yeah.
Students?
Hmm?
Oh, maybe not.
What?
I thought it might have mentioned before. Mm,
no.
Friends?
Yeah, the dating relationships, their roles implicit in that. Roommate? You got a roommate there? Ralph and Jenny are now officially cohabitors. So they're in a cohabiting relationship, which implies roles. And then there are the traditional male-female roles that they have fallen into, which you would never allow yourselves to fall into, right? For those of you who are on the web listening to this, there are 6 women in the review session. Okay. That's why they picked this up. Men don't come to review sessions. No, that's a stereotype. Got any dyads?
The beginning.
Well, observational dyad.
And then it goes to joint activity.
Uh-huh. What's the joint activity?
When they eat lunch and then they go to a party.
Uh-huh.
And then it goes to the, yeah, when they eat lunch and then the party.
Mm-hmm.
And then it's the primary.
Yep. Chatting over several lunches. Makes it a joint activity. And then, what makes it primary? Where's the first hint of primary?
After dating.
Even earlier.
The party and they look forward to seeing each other.
Looking forward to seeing each other. Okay, so they're thinking about each other before lunch and anticipating that. That makes it at least a low-level primary dyad. Then what happens to the activities? The first joint activity is observing, watching, then chatting, next activity, going to a party, dating, then moving in, living together. Okay, so over time you can see that the activities that they're doing become more complex. And chatting is much simpler than living together. An ecological transition? Okay, becoming a couple is a change in role. Another ecological transition? Ecological transition is a change in role or setting. Or both. So when Jenny moves in,
she kind of becomes like the caretaker.
Yeah. The ecological transition that generates that is that Jenny changes her setting. So she's living now in the apartment or room, whatever it is, the apartment. Okay. And then she falls into that traditional role. We'll look at that again in a couple of weeks when we look at cohabitation and the dangers, but also male-female roles, which are very deeply ingrained. Whether we want them to be or not, they're there.
Even though it doesn't say, like, it talks about how she takes up more of, like, cleaning the apartment and stuff, does it imply that Ralph cleaning the apartment with, like, kind of weird?
If the apartment is a bit grubby, is it likely that Ralph's roommate did any cleaning?
Well, like cook, to be an example, so like the microwave, mm-hmm. so that he
It sounds like Ralph has some limited skills. The apartment isn't clean. He doesn't cook much. So, what? Sounds like a normal guy. And would you like to marry a normal guy or somebody with a higher developmental status? And what kind of molar activities would you like him to engage in on his own without being told?
Cooking and cleaning.
Laundry. Yeah. Okay, so as far as household things go, he may be a nuclear physicist, we don't know that. But at least within this microsystem, the activities that he does are fairly low level. Right, at least of the ones mentioned. Falling into a comfortable routine. What are they doing? What is a routine? In Bronfenbrot.
Molar activities.
And there's some molar activities in it. And what else? Yeah, well, activities, if not molar. Cooking, cleaning, laundry. And those are activities. And what else is part of the routine? I'm sorry? How often you do it. So there's some pattern to it. And the roles we've already mentioned. Okay. Because she's doing some things and he's doing the others. They're male-female roles of the traditional sort. Is there a relation here? Jenny and Ralph? Hopefully. Okay. They're doing things together. They probably sleep together, they eat together, they watch television together, the sorts of things you would normally expect. So what are we describing? You're falling into a routine. A pattern of roles, relationships, and activities, otherwise known as a microsystem, okay, that happens in this apartment. So now that they've moved in, they're creating the microsystem. It was disrupted. There was one in it, in this apartment. There was one with Ralph and his roommate, and whatever their pattern was. But when Ralph's roommate moves out and Jenny moves in, then the relations in that setting change. So instead of roommates, it's now cohabiting partners. They change the physical arrangement, they rearrange the furniture and they bring in new things. So the physical space itself has been altered. And then they start figuring out how to do things and when to do them and how often and who's going to do them. That's the microsystem. That pattern of doing things weekly, of who does what, where they do it, where things go, you know, that's all part of creating the microsystem. Anything here suggest a mesosystem.
Where they work
would be a setting.
The grocery store?
Grocery store. Yeah. A shared setting. They do the grocery shopping together. Suppose they still chat over lunch at work. I'm sorry.
Maybe they still eat together,
but they might not chat as much. So they've created, instead of one shared setting, the cafeteria, they now have the apartment as a shared setting. So their mesosystems overlap and they've become a transcontextual dyad. So they go from work, presumably, to the apartment, maybe even together. So they're spending a lot more time together, probably. And then they've added the grocery store. If they're doing it at a store or market, wherever they are. Okay, so that's the sort of thing that we did yesterday in class, and you know, there'll be something like that with specific questions to identify the elements that we can interpret using Bronfenbrenner. We'll come back to that specific example when we talk about male-female roles and cohabitation and Uncle Larry's advice about what not to do. If you want to anticipate that, you can think about how you would make cohabitation be as developmentally facilitating as possible. If it works for them.
If she's happy doing it, like my mom does all the same things, and I asked her about it, and then she said she wouldn't want to do anything else. Like, she loves the family. So.
Yep.
We told her she should fight it, but my parents would have a lot of problems. but I guess my dad knows when to chime in.
Yeah. The analysis we'll spend most energy on is looking at first cohabitations, when people decide to live together, and the reason why most of those relationships break up, and why they don't last when people think they will, but the majority of them don't. And why cohabiting doesn't increase your chances of having a lasting marriage. So we'll look at that. That's next unit. We'll get into that. Fun stuff. Other thoughts about the whole enterprise of developmental analysis? You can pronounce it now and spell it. You won't have to on the exam. And you've already explained to your grandparents what you're studying? And they understood? Primary transition is when you move from one primary setting to another. How's that for begging the question? What is a primary setting? A primary setting is one that has the impact of promoting the development of a developmental trajectory. Bronfenbrenner defines it within that context, that when you have settings that promote the development of complex molar activities and get you moving or keep you moving along a particular trajectory, he considers that an important setting, and therefore he'll call it primary. And a primary transition is one where you're moving, for example, from your parents' home to college. Or in the case of Jenny and Ralph, in that example, moving in together is a primary transition for her. She's moving from wherever she was living to a setting that is likely to be very important in her development. And then he ties that concept to the fact that sometimes you don't know how much you've developed until you go through a primary transition and are in a quite new situation and discover how well developed you are, what kind of skills you have, because you get tested in them. Or don't. Mm-hmm. You discover that you're not very competent. The transition from college to work, for example, at graduation, is a primary transition. You're hoping not to have to do that, but right. But it's a big one. Home to college is a big one. And when you watch people go through that transition, particularly here at UVM and other colleges, you watch a whole group of people go through it at the same time, you discover that there are people who are on a trajectory that allows them to adapt to the new setting very well and very easily. And they come in and figure things out pretty quickly and get down to work and don't end up on academic probation and don't get in trouble and get their work done and finish all their courses and the first semester. And then you see other people who are totally lost as they go through that primary transition. And then you ask, what kind of environment have they come from? What has been their developmental trajectory that made it more difficult for them to come into this new setting and lose their bearings, not have the skills to deal with it? College to on your own or college to back home? Yeah. Yeah. Better than being home all the time?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. It is difficult. Why is that? In Bronfenbrennerian terms, why is the transition from home, from college to home? You got your first taste of it perhaps over Thanksgiving break. Some of you got it over between semester break. Some people get it again spring break. What's the problem with going back? Uh-huh. Right. Mm-hmm. So Proposition F, which says that the specific settings have different possibilities, different potential for activities. UVM is an incredible smorgasbord. There's too much to do here. Burlington is that way, even for grown-ups. You know, there's always something to do. I could do two somethings almost every night of the week. There's something scheduled here that, if I had enough money and enough time, I could be entertained. You know, I could do a couple of things every night. And as a student, there's even more because you're living with dozens of other students and there are lectures and stuff to do and a library to go to and incredible amounts of stuff to do. And you live in a place where once you get home, yep, there's not much to do. And your family's not nearly as interesting as the 100 people on the in the residence hall that you're close to, and they don't offer you nearly as much entertainment. So the number of dyadic relationships and the number of activities is really, really small. I remember going particularly visiting with my girlfriend's family in college, and there wasn't a whole bunch for me to do there. And one of the things that I ended up falling into was watching late night television with her younger brother, and totally screwed up my routine and made me feel like a slug. Going to bed late, sleeping late, not doing anything. You can only talk to the little brother. I mean, he's a nice guy, but you can only watch so many late night movies and have a conversation for a while. So it is tough because the environment when you go home may be much less engaging. For other people, the environment actually does offer quite a bit. So there are other problems. And one of those is that in that setting at home, there's a microsystem, pattern of roles, relationships, and activities that you have spent years in. And then you left it. And that microsystem changed a little bit without you. But when you come back in, and this is a basic tenet of family systems, is that when the people are gathered again together, they fall into the roles that they had before you left. So you come to college and you do a whole bunch of developing and are responsible for yourself and don't have a curfew and can come and go as you please and set your own schedule. And then you go home and your parents expect you to be just the way you were just before you left for college. And you're not. But the system is set up, the pattern expects you to be. So they wake you up in the morning for breakfast. Yuck. They expect you to do what you did, and they expect you to have a curfew, and they expect you to communicate with them the way you did when you were in high school. And they haven't changed. The terrible thing about parents is they don't change a lot. And they do other things when they realize you're really gone. But when you come back, they want you to fit back into the same dyadic relationships. And it's a struggle for many people to get them to accept the change. Proposition C says they eventually will. You've gone through developmental change, eventually they will too, but they have to have the transactions and engage in the communication and the activities to realize that you've changed. So at first it's difficult, and it takes a period of time, in many cases, for people to sort that out and create a different microsystem, one that has different roles. Some of us like going back into the same microsystem and the same role. I used to love going home and let my mother cook for me and do my laundry that I had been doing on my own and fuss over me and take care of me. That's delightful. And it pleased her too. But only for a period of time. After a while, it drives you nuts. So you have to change it. So you have that primary setting, primary transition of going back to the original setting may be really difficult. And who was it said you can't go home again? Sometimes you've changed so much that you really can't go home and be comfortable. You can't stay at home. That's a major theme, just to expand that a little bit. It's a major theme in the stories of people who go to college for the first time. They're the first people in their families to go to college. Because, and I mentioned this in class, that sometimes people whose parents didn't go to college don't have the knowledge about what goes on at college. They haven't been through the same kinds of experiences or changes, so they can't be as helpful to you. They can't help you sort out what's going on in college because they don't have the experience. So that makes it harder to come to college when you don't have that experience or that information. But at the same time, it means that when you go home, people really don't understand what you've experienced. And many times when people try to go back to the same community and live with their families who haven't had the same kind of experience, it's difficult, and you realize that you don't fit in, particularly if it's a larger community of people who've never been anyplace. Then you don't share the experiences, you don't share a view of the world anymore with them. You don't fit into their macro system, because your view of the world has changed, and you've seen different things. One of the columnists in the paper is a Hispanic American. I knew I'd block on his name if I tried to say it. Ruben Navarro, who's from a farming community of immigrant Mexicans in California, went to Harvard. And he wrote a book after college about the difficulty of making the transition back and forth, and the difficulties of feeling comfortable with his family and friends who didn't go anywhere, and him having the experience of having been to college. And they didn't know what it was about, and they expected him to be like all the other kids, and he wasn't. Did some of you come from communities where there are high school classmates who didn't go to college, who don't go? Yeah. It gets harder and harder to go back and hang out with them. That was my experience. Only about 10% of the kids in my high school went to college. And most of them still live in the same community, and the community hasn't changed much. And I can't go there. I can have an interesting class reunion, picnic, things like that, but there's no way I could live there. Because what goes on there is completely foreign to me. I can't fit into that system anymore. Enough? Yeah. We'll do it again tomorrow. Come back. Email us. Email Julie. We're happy to talk. And get a good night's sleep on Sunday night.